Hello, 1517 podcast listeners. This is Caleb Keith, director of the 1517 Podcast Network, with a brief announcement for you. 1517 will be participating in Giving Tuesday this year, that is November 28th, with a $200,000 goal. Our Giving Tuesday campaign has a matching fund this year, and so every dollar you give will be matched. We appreciate your support for the podcast network and for the rest of what 1517 does. We work hard to provide high-quality, Christ-centered resources every single day of the week. If you've been enjoying this podcast or many of the other things at 1517, we ask you to please consider supporting 1517 during this crucial time. The end of the year is important for us as we look to close our budgetary needs for 2023 and start off strong in 2024. A $200,000 goal is ambitious, but I know with the support of our listeners on the podcast network and many of the other friends and partners of 1517 that we will be able to reach this goal. Please consider supporting your favorite podcast and the rest of the projects at 1517 today by going to 1517.org/GivingTuesday and making a gift, or you can follow the link in the show notes below that says support this podcast on Giving Tuesday. We thank all of you who continue to partner with 1517 to provide these resources, and I hope you enjoyed this episode of your favorite 1517 podcast.
Hello there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb Keith, and the Thinking Fellows is brought to you by the 1517 podcast network of shows. You can go to 1517.org/podcast to see all of our shows there. Today, I am joined by Scott Keith, Adam Francisco, and Bruce Hillman. Our topic today is, where have all the Christians gone? Where have all the Christians gone? We are looking at the sort of latest polling information from Pew Research Center on the religious nuns, N-O-N-E-S, not N-U-N-S. This is a familiar topic.
It's funny to me, whenever you say that, people, their minds automatically go to habits and singing.
Yeah. And basically the...
Actually, it's not really funny, Scott. No, sorry, Susan.
Now, this survey is a refresh of a survey that I believe came out in 2010.
It says 7.
I think their data starts in 7, but the last one that Pew did was in 10. And the 2010 religious nuns survey caused quite a bit of commotion amongst Christians and people with podcasts and university professors and churches and pastors.
All the rage to talk about at the university, and still in 2011 and 12.
You could almost not run into a Christian who wasn't talking about it. Now, what's interesting to me is I went through this one, and there was some regional information here as well. And in 2010, it was much less bad than this new one. And this new one's been out getting close to a month, I saw it. And nobody's talking about it at all, and it's much, much worse than in 2010 situation.
Do you think people aren't surprised as much now as they were in 2010? Like, was anyone expecting it to go up? Was anyone expecting to be like...
I think you're probably right about that. Yeah, I think you're probably right about that. And I did, Albert Mueller just did a podcast on it, Thinking in Public.
Okay, good.
I mean, roundabout on, he did it on secularism with a secularist, but... they really got into it.
Now, for the Thinking Fellows and for, I would say, probably listeners of this show in particular, I think some of the data is relevant for a couple of reasons. In the 2010 one, the major decline was primarily coastal, really concentrated in California, Oregon, Washington, New York, places like that. But the heartland in the South, it wasn't so bad. There was a downward trend, but it wasn't very bad. Now, regionally, basically everybody's on par with California, with a couple of outliers like Washington State, which is particularly bad. But for the most part, we're where California was in 2010, and California hasn't really seen much change, which is interesting. And the other notable thing, and this happens right at the beginning, I'm going to put a link to Pew's website thing here in this. The other notable thing is the only people really losing practitioners of their faith are Protestants. Everybody else either stayed the same or gained. And Protestants across the board, conservative, liberal, liturgical, contemporary, are lost 15% of attendees or people who are willing to call themselves a Christian.
I have so many thoughts on this.
So that it is too. Where to begin?
Tap me in whenever you want to tap me in.
Everybody's itching. Let's give Adam. Adam, why don't
I don't
you
know where to begin. I kind of think that while the numbers are bad, I think it's much worse than what Pew's published, at least if the Barna group is to be believed. You know, because I didn't read every word of that report that you sent. Skimmed it, because I keep abreast of the stuff, but I've just sort of lost interest in all the survey details, statistical details. But the Barna report, what was it, like a year ago came out, and you know, the criteria or the standards, you know, one could argue with that, but they found that something like less than 10% of Christians actually have a worldview that could be described as a biblical worldview. Now, we could take issue with what they count as a biblical worldview, but that's the alarming thing. And then I think it was Barna as well that surveyed clergy mm-hmm. in Protestant groups and found that pastors and other, like we maybe call them church workers, lack basic biblical knowledge, you know, like in high numbers, which was surprising.
The Barna one also included that American Christians are aggressive liars too, because it also had the statistics.
Aggressive liars?
Yeah. Aggressive liars. Like, no, in the sense that,
I know, Adam's like, oh geez, we're getting Caleb unfiltered today. What are we going to do?
Well, in the sense that, they did church reporting of attendance, there, like annually, and it was like 50% lower than people's reporting of how often they go to the church they're, quote, member at, too. So people lie about how much they go to church, how much they pray, how much they read the Bible when they do these. Yeah. So I tend to agree with you, Adam, that while this is bad, it's probably worse because people lie to pollsters.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, but if you take a long historical view, it's not all that shocking, I don't think. Think about the Middle Ages. Bruce, I'm not sure, and this might be outside your realm, but you, since you have like knowledge of all kinds of strange things, you may know. It was Eamon Duffy and these mostly Reformation historians who were more, you know, were pro-Catholic, or their biases were Catholic, as they're trying to explain what caused the Reformation. They will oftentimes highlight that in the late Middle Ages, church attendance had sort of, even though we think of that as the era of Christendom, there was a steep decline in regular church attendance in the Middle Ages. And then I've read, there's a book, I forget the author's name, but I think it's called The History of Secularism. And it came out a long time ago, maybe 15 years ago. And the author, like the thesis of the author is, I think it's Graham Wood might be the author's name, but he argues that if, you know, when we look at these numbers, we have to take into account or bear in mind that behind that is sort of like some sort of standard of the way things ought to be. Or in his case, when he was looking at Britain, he said usually that the decline in church attendance is measured against like a large church attendance or a high percentage of church attendance in the Victorian era, which was a historical anomaly in England. So things aren't all relative. No offense, Bruce, in your, I don't want to offend your postmodernism, but you have to take all this stuff with a grain of salt too. But in all this, the one thing that always comes to my mind is back, 15 years ago in Newsweek or Time, can't remember which one, they ran an article with the title, We're All Hindus Now. And it was based off of that first Pew finding on this. And the author argued that, while I guess 15 years ago, 75% of Americans would call themselves Christians. But what Pew found in that initial report is that if you start asking those people who self-identified as Christians, that there was just, I mean, if Christian is more than just a name, but actually is a description of somebody who has a particular worldview. Even if we're generous in how we define that worldview, it found that half of those 75% of Americans who identified as Christians actually hold beliefs that are radically inconsistent with any sense of a biblical worldview. For example, a belief in reincarnation or kind of a universalism, hence the title, We're All Hindus Now. And it was, which was like, you know, that's hyperbole, right? But it had a point. But I don't know, you look at, and Boris would probably be the guy to ask on the details of this, but American history, though we oftentimes, though it does have a majority Christian past, it's still, even since the founding, even before the founding, has always had, there's always been this pull away from Christianity, whether it's in deism or spiritualism, romanticism, or what have you. So,
in part,
the numbers are bad, and they may be alarming for those who are really, who follow this stuff. At the same time, it's not all that, maybe it's because I'm grumpy, like your father, not today, but, no, in terms of like, well, no, I think we're more realistic, it's like, okay, I mean, this is kind of what we expect.
Dan's...
When the Son of Man returns, will he find faith on earth?
Yeah.
So, just real, man.
Dan's video, which has done very well on our YouTube channel, I think probably the best performing one, called Is America a Christian Nation? In there, I think it's 40 minutes long, and there's a section there where he talks about the extreme waves that America's gone through in church attendance, down to, you know, practically nobody, to the revivals come around, and then whole parts of the country become church attending, and then some social and political reasons that reward church attendance and gives you sort of this stable period. And now we're in a period where there is no social political benefit to being a member of a church or identifying as Christian. And so that stability seems to be going away. And I think that's part of what explains that the stability is across Protestantism, sort of no matter which Protestant denomination you look at, whether they have liturgical or contemporary worship practices, whether they're conservative or liberal, is that, and this is, we can sort of say this is sad, and I think this is consistent with what you're saying, Adam, that people, a lot of people don't, who say they're Christian, don't have Christian beliefs. They're not in church because of the doctrine. They're not in church because of the preaching. They're in church because of the social, economic, and political benefits that it has. And as those have faded, church attendance has faded.
Can I be more pessimistic than you and less pessimistic at the same time?
Go for it.
I think there's a lot of trying to read people's motives into this, which is interesting, because that's going to be guessing, which is fine. It's a podcast. We deal in conjecture every day, so that's great. There are some realities. If you want to talk like timelines of when faith practice was highest in this country as far as what people might have in their actual memory and not just from a history book, you're going to be talking post-World War II, 1950s, when faith not only was stated faith very high, but state and observable practice was very high too. Church attendance was growing across all Christian denominations.
Bing Crosby was playing priests on TV all the time in best movie.
Elf. Yeah. You know, everybody on a TV show that sat down before dinner, they prayed. You know, you had all of this stuff. And then you had some other things too. You know, it's in the 50s kind of when you get this start. This comes in waves too, even in American history. I mean, but in our kind of modern history, this start of really raising people to be individualistic, you get the increase in technology, and just historically, anytime you have affluence take over a society, what you have is things, many good things happen, right? People live longer, you get more technologies that make life easier. But inevitably, all those technologies that make life easier make things more self-centered. You actually need fewer children, you have fewer children, on and on and on. And when all of this happens, you know, this practice goes down, or this faith goes down, for the same reasons that we see things like woke increase. You know, you have a hyper-individualistic society that isn't joining to any degree any group, official group, benevolent organizations, churches, civic societies, at rates that they did when it was all, you know, rah-rah USA, let's build this country to be the greatest country on the planet. You know, all of those things, let's fight the godless Soviets. All of those things lended towards people, you know, really joining a lot of things, including Christian organizations, Christian churches, the whole nine yards. But I do think that in a lot of cases, when people got into sort of the churches, it did matter. It did, and I have to believe it still does matter what is taught and preached in those churches. But what you have right now is just an overwhelming push of society that has made inroads into the churches. I mean, I'll just give one example. I am the executive director of what's been described sometimes as an evangelical missionary and tract society. But I'll just say of an evangelical organization that attempts to declare and defend the good news that you're forgiven and free on account of Christ alone in multiple different ways all the time. So I'm not making an anti-evangelism statement here. I am all about evangelism and apologetics. This is sort of definitional to what we do at 1517 and who I am. But a lot of what you're seeing could just be declining birth rates.
Yeah.
You know, when you have declining birth rate, I mean, Matthew Harrison of the LCMS wasn't wrong when he said, you know, well, I think it was around the time this first study came out, that, you know, people in our churches need to have more babies, because historically one of the ways our church has grown is by baptism of babies. I'm like, and people freaked out about that. Oh, doesn't he think we should evangelize a world that's in need of hearing the gospel? I think he does believe that we should do that. And I think, you know, they've got a missions organization over there at the LCMS that is very active and attempts to do just that. But I don't think he was wrong either when you say that. When you have, you know, the population within a group of people whose first command was to be fruitful and multiply, and they no longer do that, right? And then you look 20, 30, 40 years later and you say, geez, man, it really looks like you're going down in numbers. They're literally going down in numbers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're literally going down in numbers. And so when you go, oh my gosh, you're going down in numbers, boy, are people rejecting the faith? Well, maybe, but maybe they're just not being born into and raised in and catechized in the faith in the first place. All of these can, in our contributing factors, are people leaving the Protestant churches? Sure they are, but they're probably not leaving them at the rate that they're just not being born into them.
I think that's true.
I actually looked this up because I agree with you, Scott. And so from 2007, which is when the Pew Research started being done, until now, there's been a 23% drop in birth rate
right.
in the United States. So if, and it's not a one-to-one correlation, but if it's 40% drop overall from 2007 to 2023 in church attendance, but there's been a 23% drop in birth rate, and then it would be interesting to see, and I didn't find this data specifically within people who identify as Christian, what's the drop in birth rate? It might even be higher than 23%.
Well, I was going to say, again, conjecture, great. But there's a couple churches that aren't declining, Roman Catholics and Latter-day Saints. Okay, so, and if you have lived as an adherent of Roman Catholicism, you're not using birth control. Right? Now, are a lot of them? Probably, but technically, you're not using birth control. Technically, you're having more kids than the average person in the population.
And technically, marriage is incentivized by the religion.
Technically, marriage is incentivized by the religion. If you're Latter-day Saints, like, you don't get your special planet with the wife that you want unless you have seven kids. So you're going to be like trying to knock those kids out like Corbin.
Is that the number? You have to have seven?
I believe it's seven, yeah.
Or are you? Okay. Wow.
But I was just going to say, to this point, though, as we look to the future, there's another thing to look at too, which is immigration, particularly in the United States. And so I looked at that as well. And
immigration from Roman Catholic countries.
The highest increase in immigration in the last 5 years has been Asian Americans, followed very closely by Latinos.
Right.
Now, it's interesting.
And Asian Americans often from countries like the Philippines.
Right. The largest Asian, I'm sorry, yeah, the largest subset of Asian Americans, I believe, is Indian Americans. And the largest Hindu temple in the Western Hemisphere was just completed in New Jersey a few weeks ago. The huge unveiling. Mm-hmm. It's massive. You should look it up. It's like a city. It's a major, major Hindu temple. I think the prime minister of India is actually coming over to like do something with it because it's such a big symbol. So you're probably going to see an increase in an acceptance to Hinduism, which will probably stay more localized within Indian culture. But you might see stuff like Buddhism and spirituality increase in American culture because it's much easier to go in if Asian American culture becomes more predominant. But you're also going to get Latino culture, and Latino culture is going to increase the birth rate and also Catholic. It's going to increase the Catholic numbers if they continue to maintain their Catholic attendance. So, like Adam said, it's probably worse than what we're seeing, which I think is true. And I think there's a gray wave coming where a lot of Christians are going to die off in the next 10 years because there's a lot of old, and those numbers are going to plummet.
Well,
but you also have this immigration happening,
yeah,
which is also going to soften some of that blow as well.
And Orthodox Jews are taking over Judaism even in places like Manhattan.
And that's a birth rate.
Simply because they're having kids. Same thing in Israel. Israel was founded as a very secular country. It's now, you know, the rates at which that the Orthodox Jews in Israel are having children are greatly outnumbering any of the secular Jews there. And they will be the predominant political force in the future there.
Don't doubt the power of a new Cold War on religion.
Well, this is what
the '50s were a high point for religion. Well, part of that was because like we defined ourselves in the West as not being like the Soviets.
Well, Bruce, don't doubt that if all of these crazy things that are happening all over the world actually begin to hit our affluence here harder than they have currently, that people will turn to religion because that's what they do in times of hardship.
And I like where this is turning because I think the second part of this episode in my mind is addressing the next thing that you heard in 2010 and the fallout after, and that I think people initially react with, which is, what can my church change right now to, you know, stop the bleeding? And in many ways, the answer is sadly nothing, because these other global and social issues contribute so much to the attendance. I do think the thing you can do, and this gets sort of to 1517, is to preach the gospel, to teach Orthodox Christianity, to catechize well, so that when these cultural storms up and downs go, and it's all of a sudden harder to be a Christian culturally or socially, where there's less incentive to, and it might not even be harder because of oppression, just because there's fewer of you, and you have to justify yourself and your existence to more and more people, that they're really embedded believers. Like Adam, I think, this is also speculation, but what you identified with sort of general orthodoxy or creedalism probably improves as the numbers go down too, because those left there are in all likelihood your most sort of, for lack of a better word, radical or committed constituents.
But I think the data shows the opposite of that, though. The data shows consistently over the last decade that Pentecostalism is the significantly fastest growing Protestant
one.
And I think part of the reason why Pentecostalism is growing,
that is recently churned. Specifically any portion of that that's dispensational.
Say, what about the dispensational? Say
that it's collapsing. It's collapsing.
Dispensational churches like Pentecostals have hit a plateau. Yeah. So I think
I think they're actually collapsing the whole movement itself is turning in on itself. That's all. That's for another
show. Yeah, it may be trending down, but I'm saying it's still a significant. It's still the
outpacing.
Yeah,
the other Protestants.
Well, I'm not saying, and I wouldn't say that it's necessarily like Orthodox teaching that makes something grow, but passionate teaching about, you know, and I would hope Orthodox Christianity, Bruce, I think can and does have an impact.
My point would also be within the micro, like, environment of your synod. So as your synod dies, the people left are those who most closely identify or most passionately believe the particular confessions of your church. So, and I would think that's true in Pentecostalism as well. I think that would be true in the Reformed, not just Orthodox in the general sense of Christian Orthodoxy, but in the smaller O Orthodox of their church. When it, you know, for instance, your millennials that are in churches, I should find the link to this one too. Millennials who have stayed in Protestant churches tend to be the most conservative of their generation.
I mean, there,
religiously, and
there is an answer to this. I've been saying it since I wrote Being Dad. It's a 20 to 30 year solution. It's raise children that want to get married and have children, and then once those boys that you've raised have had children and are fathers, make sure that they're active in the church and that they're spiritual leaders of their household, and then those kids will, by the numbers, stay in the church on the whole. And then, but this is exactly what.
Anyways, it gets harder to be a Christian. I would contest that. So I would just say, as it gets harder to be a Christian because of the cultural pressures, you can raise Christian young men, for example, or women. But there's no guarantee. There might not even be a probability anymore that they would stay in the faith. So if they're growing up in a church and it's all surrounded by 80-year-olds, you know, they're going, I'm out of here. So I don't necessarily true.
I balk at that every time. This is not necessarily true. And the only way it could be proved would be by anecdotal evidence, which I could present anecdotal evidence to the opposite. I could present anecdotal evidence to the opposite in my own family and with the children I've raised. And it's...
I'm saying the environment's different now. You're dealing with.
It wasn't, though. If you were to ask Caleb,
it was.
Who was in his church, he'd say it was a bunch of 67 and 80-year-olds growing up.
I would say
the outside culture has changed.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Well,
that's what the study that we're
talking. I have two millennials and one Z-er.
Well, okay. I do think the outside culture has changed in this sense. Bruce, I think you're starting to feel it. But in California, like if we go to 2010, it's basically unchanged. It's been this bad since I was a freshman in high school. I'm pretty young, you know. I'm a baby with four kids.
It's a baby.
So it's been this bad in California,
millennial,
for a long time. The rest of the country is now looks more like California on religious belief and
everything else.
Basically everything, and which is not surprising. I do think it is harder to be a Christian when it is just 80-year-olds. Anecdotally, I've heard that from other people my age with kids. It's also hard to when you finally do have a church that is outnumbered, like ours, because, you know, I'm having so many kids. Our children outnumber our over 60s on Sunday morning attendance now. People under 30 outnumber people over 60.
Is that true?
It is true.
Yeah.
Which is pretty amazing and pretty rare.
It's hard to see, though, because like the ones who help outnumber the old people are so little that you're like,
yeah.
It's hard to like actually visualize it on Sunday morning.
But by the numbers, our under 30s outnumber it. It's hard to convince anybody else to come.
Boy, a lot of them got the same last name, too.
Yeah, to come experience that, though. You know, you'll run into neighbors who are said, oh, we stopped going to church because we felt like there was no place for us. And you go, there's a church with a lot of young people
that.
In
you
it.
You got to hear the second part of what I said, is that make sure your churches let the young men then get involved. Okay. And now, this is the data on this is not anecdotal. It's just not anecdotal. It's well documented over the course of the last 30 years that if there is a father who is active in the church, who brings his children to church, who is a spiritual leader in his house, by the numbers, on the whole, those kids will stay in the faith. The relationship that the father has with those children as the chief catechist, or however you want to look at it, it has the potential to outweigh the influence of society.
And one of the you know, the cultural sort of forces, and I think you could include parents in that, there's things that allow people to persevere through that it's harder to be a Christian culturally. And I don't want to downplay like how difficult it is to be in a church that is sort of culturally irrelevant and has no cultural benefits and doesn't have people who look like you in it. But I do think that can be overcome by sort of, you know, radical or strong religious conviction that is taught in the home and things like that. So, and maybe taught in your church, even if that doesn't have 100% success rates. So we should probably, well, I can put a link to Being Dad in the,
as well, you should,
in the show notes, that has sort of data, about it. And, you know, in some ways you can also bring up the concern of, well, you know, does having the right cultural forces make people Christian? Doesn't that oppose that the gospel is what creates and sustains faith?
And not if what you're saying about that cultural force is that they need to be a mouthpiece of the gospel in the home.
And I would add this, I think that's correct, but I would also add this, that getting people to the place where the proclamation of the gospel happens or being in those places is not purely gospel, but is law. And law of being raised, law of your culture, first use of the law, and things like that. And so having the opportunity having pressures that push people into spaces where the gospel is going to be proclaimed is also important in addition to that. And I think stuff like the fatherhood thing may be evidence to the fact that having a strong father pushes you into a space where you hear that gospel more frequently, and it's reinforced at times of doubt. But alas,
strong and gracious and gospel-minded.
So we can go back to some of the original stuff here, which is basically, it's just us in decline. That is American Protestants, Lutherans, you know, Calvinists, Reformed, Baptists, and general evangelicals. We're the ones declining. Now, some religions, even though they're statistically less relevant in the United States, are not declining. And especially globally, we have Adam's favorite hobby horse, and one that has gotten us many downloads in the past.
This is expertise, not his.
It's the only thing that keeps me relevant.
Which is,
like the last 10 years, I've not been relevant. Now I'm relevant again.
Islam is not
October
is not declining, right, Adam?
It's not globally, to be sure. In America, it's kind of, it's the numbers. It's hard to know Muslim demographics in America because you got to ask the question, what constitutes a Muslim? Are the Ahmadis, which is like a heretical group that's here because they got their heads cut off in Iran for so many decades. Do they belong? And so on and so forth. But there is, in terms of Islamic institutions, that's the way to count it in the U.S. It probably, if any of our listeners are living in and around urban areas, they've seen mosques go up year after year. I drive by when I go into River Forest to teach on Tuesdays and Thursdays. I drive by three mosques that are being built, which is kind of surprising to me. Where you're going to see it, I don't know that the predictions are going to pan out the way they were suggested back in like the first decade of the 21st century, but by 2050, it's projected that of the voting population in Europe, close to a majority of them will be Muslim primarily because of birth rates. Now we have, the early predictions were, what's that?
Is that also because of refugees in the last 10 years as well?
Well, that's a special case because they aren't necessarily going to be voters. Okay. But early on, the predictions were quite alarming. You know, people were routinely talking about Eurabia. You know, Europe is going to look more like Eurabia by 2050. As Muslims assimilate into Western culture, though,
their birth rates
see they
down.
Kind of follow behind. Yeah, the birth rates go down as they get a taste of the crass Western materialism and all that goes along with it. They start to lose their integrity.
It's the same thing with immigrants to the United States, even immigrants from
oh yeah, absolutely.
South America who if in South America would still have a relatively high birth rate, once they get here, their children's birth rate matches, you know, the native population very quickly.
Yeah. But the thing with Islam is even in America, you'll see it. It won't be like a obvious thing, but if you're aware of it, you'll see it, is that, you know, in Islam, you cannot outlaw polygamy. That would be a breach of what's clearly taught in the Quran, and that's strongly forbidden in Islam. And so you'll have, while one woman might not have that many children, a man will be married officially to one woman, but will have other wives, according to Islamic custom, will have more children. So it's, but in terms of population here in the U.S., I mean, when I'm around Muslim populations here, not purposely, but I do notice that there's always, like probably a lot of our churches that we go to, like the one you're describing in Big Bear, there's a lot of little kids running around, and it's the same in Muslim populations. Just they're kind of tracking along, I guess, the more conservative wings of Protestant and Catholic.
Well, I'd say our church up here, especially in this area, is kind of a special case, in that, and it's only because it's so small. If it were even a little bit bigger,
even a few more, you know,
if
people
we were
attended.
If we were 60 attendees and not 45 on Sunday, that wouldn't be the case.
I think even 45 is generous on a lot of Sundays. So
if we just step away from the rising birth rates of, say, Christianity is on for a minute, like that discussion of birth rates rising, and Adam, I'm curious, particularly with you, but it's open to everybody. What do you just thinking out for the future? What do you think is the success rate of evangelism within Christianity versus Islam in the United States? Like, is Islam a rival to
its growth is purely by demographic growth. Now, globally, Muslims will claim it's by conversion because people see the light and so on and so forth. I just don't think there's the evidence to support that.
I saw one the other day that was, so Nigeria is basically split Muslim and Christian in the south and the north, and they've now hit the inversion point where Islam is outgrowing Christianity, but it's basically completely linked to birth rate, that the Christians have a much lower birth rate than Muslims.
Yeah, and Africa is kind of interesting with respect to this type of question because, African bishops, like Anglican bishops, will oftentimes tell Western Christians that the more they align themselves with like LGBTQ or other progressive issues, the more Africans who are kind of sitting on the fence, if you will, between Islam and Christianity are not going to Christianity. Their perception might be wrong, right? But that their perception is that Christianity basically follows the Western progressivist trends, and they know by nature that this just isn't appropriate, so they go for Islam. It might be a really bad reason to choose a religion, but that's just what's going on. Scott, can we go back to when you talked about you mentioned Matthew Harrison, President Harrison of the LCMS, and when that report came out, and he made a statement. Was it in a letter, or
I think it was like one of those emailed letters that
encouraging people to have more children or larger families or what have you. And everybody kind of freaked out. And then they said, well, what about evangelism? And I think you're dead right. In fact, I know you're right that Matt or Dr. President Harrison, I guess is the appropriate, I shouldn't call him Max, I don't know personally, but I don't think he would poo-poo at all evangelism. In fact, I think he's a staunch supporter of missions and evangelism.
I think he really is. But
I think in our conversation, we've kind of focused on this demographic growth. Lyman Stone, who's a demographic researcher.
LCMS.
Says that within the LCMS, focusing on that, but it probably extends to other church bodies, that demographic growth is essential if you're interested in preserving something at current numbers or strengths or what have you. But along with it also has to be a evangelical or missionary evangelistic zeal. The way he put it once was on par with what we see amidst Mormons.
Well, you won't even, if you don't have an evangelistic zeal, you won't even evangelize your own children.
Right.
Is my larger point, is that you need this evangelistic zeal, but you can't then say we don't need to grow demographically. So, you know, it can be one and the same thing to say we need to have an evangelistic zeal, and that also needs to happen through baby baptisms.
Yeah. And in fact, probably should start there.
Yeah.
I guess the only reason why I wanted to bring this topic up again is, just focusing on one thing, you kind of lose sight of the other. Not that we were doing that, but I mean, I just think it's important to say that not only do we concentrate on catechizing concentrate on catechizing our young and bring them to baptism and so on and so forth, but also just the age old, you know, bring your friends to church, speak the gospel to your friends and in your social groups. Good heavens, that's why you're here on earth.
Yeah.
Remember
that those sort of those spheres of vocational influence kind of work outward and start with the smallest one, which is you and your own family, and then to your friend group, and then to your work group, and then to your neighborhood, and then out and out and out and out.
Yeah.
To all of those people, you are called to preach the gospel.
Yeah.
And
I think of C.S. Lewis's picture in Mere Christianity, or The Case for Christianity, towards after he gets through his natural or his moral law argument, where he talks about the incarnation as if God has sort of like, he's like, I can't remember the exact phrase, but he's like this, he's like an invading army, and Christians are kind of like counter insurgents.
Yeah.
For a guy like me, I like that imagery. Some people might be appalled and it might microaggress them and so on, but.
Oh my.
Well, so I apologize, Bruce, but.
The funny thing too is like, if you look at the one of the first graphs in this thing is kind of helps with this in this sense. Protestants or Christians had a 15% decline in people who in the poll said they were Christian, and non-believer of all stripes had a 14% increase, which, you know, to answer the question, where are the Christians going? Well, mostly to non-belief in that case. And what that means, though, is that 14% of, at least 14% of identifying non-believers in anything have at least some exposure or experience with Christianity. Having a conversation with them about it should not be a totally foreign thing, because they likely at one point in time they called themselves a Christian. And so you're also having to, you have a mission field that once called itself Christian. And so there's an opportunity to listen to those people for the particulars about why they are not, and try to address that in the conversations and relationships that you have. But I think you are going to have to listen to those people who went from something to nothing.
Well, and Caleb, can I say, if someone's struggling with like how to start that conversation with someone they know that's on their heart, and this is self-promotion, but it's not made to, but you know, that's why we exist at 1517. That's one of the reasons we're here. And we have blogs and podcasts and all sorts of other things. You can send one of those to your friend that you think is pertinent and have a conversation with them just off of that. It doesn't have to be an awkward, like, I'm going to call them up today and ask them to what they think about Jesus. Like we have all these resources. That's what we're passionate about doing, is not only, you know, encouraging Christians who do believe, but also hoping that people will come to faith and joy in Christ as well.
Amen. That's a good place to end it.
Well, guys, thank you for listening to this episode of the Think Fellows podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please do remember to share it with your family, friends, maybe fellow church attendees, those people in your life who are not nuns. They might enjoy the Think Fellows podcast.
Share it with the nuns, too.
Yeah, share it with the nuns, too.
I mean, both the habit and singing and the N-O-N-E. Yes.
There's a place for everybody to listen to the Think Fellows podcast. You can support this show by following the Support This Show link in the top of the show notes. And you can find the rest of what we do at 1517 at 1517.org. We thank you for listening. We will catch you next time. Bye.